Did you feel, I gather your Odyssey unfolded after the Iliad in as a larger whole, or did you take stabs at it early?
Yeah, no, I took stabs. So I first did Iliad 22, then I did Iliad 1. And I said, okay, Iliad 1 I think works. But let me try some Odyssey to see what I'm going to go on and do next. And it was Odyssey 5. And I did it and memorized it and performed it a number of times. But I went back to Iliad, and it was simply a matter of the Iliad comes first in so many ways. It is the greater poem. So I thought to myself, well, since it's the greater poem, maybe I should warm up on the Odyssey and develop a little more. but I just put it first. It's hard to say why. But I knew I had a voice for the Odyssey, too. And so you're asking maybe, how are those voices different? And I'll use the same language I use when actually talking about Aratus, although in a completely different way. There is a kind of enchantment. I think Longinus puts it very well. You know, he says that the Iliad, you know, is like a storm at sea, and I'm kind of paraphrasing Longinus, and you know, black clouds and high waves and these intense beams of sunlight sometimes come down through the clouds. You know, and the Odyssey is like it's the end of the day, the sun is setting, the storm has quieted down, and you're walking along the shore, and you encounter many strange and marvelous things. You know, so the Odyssey is more storytelling. I mean, we have storytelling within storytelling, mm-hmm. you know, in the Odyssey, in a way that we just don't in the Iliad. The character of the poet is important, you know, in the Odyssey. The characters are not as intense. There's nobody like Achilles. And there's nothing in the Odyssey. If you look at the one combat, well, I suppose there's, you know, the stories Odysseus tells, there's some fighting. But, you know, the battle in the Great Hall. Oh, you know, it's nowhere near mm-hmm. an Iliadic battle. It's almost embarrassing, mm-hmm. Actually, you know. That's not what's happening in the Odyssey. Instead, we're getting into minds like Penelope's mind, which is endlessly fascinating. I think my favorite part of the Odyssey is book 19. And you have Odysseus and Penelope talking late at night, and does she recognize him? And on some subliminal level, yes, of course she must, but the maids are watching, and nobody mm-hmm. says it's never going to become overt. But, you know, her deep sorrow, the fact that when we see her the first time, you know, she's half-lit, you know, standing by a column and the firelight is on her, and she's that way again in 23. So, you know, to a scholar, the language is somewhat different, you know, and people make a lot out of that, and I don't think there's much to that. I think there was one Homer who's composing using all sorts of strata that have come down to him, imposing his own voice, his own mind upon them, and just coming out from them to compose these. Yeah, the narratorology of both poems and the way the narratorology of both poems blend into each other is absolutely astonishing mm-hmm. in itself. But we're talking now about the language because that's what the translator, has to deal with. I wish I could express it better than.
I'm going to ask you
than I am now. Maybe you can ask a leading question.
Well, here's the thing, I once came up with something, and I'm not sure to this point if it actually means anything, of calling translation as a kind of archival performance in the sense that you have, you know, your primary source text there that you're digging into and trying to kind of, but you have the riches of your own language and your moment and your tradition, right? So that you are performing an archive of many things. It seems to me you just described Homer in that light, you know, as someone who's channeling traditions.
Yeah, he is. I see what you mean by archive. You're not talking about libraries, so. But almost an archaion, you know, an original beginning. I think Homer is channeling a lot, actually, and at the same time, it's all woven into his own voice, and I think that's what poets inevitably do. You know, what poets are there who have not been immersed in other poetry? I don't think there are any at all. Actually, there are some, and they're doing readings nowadays, but that's another story. that's what it is. It's poetry producing poetry. The wonderful mind. A mind emerges from it for me. There's a mind behind it, and you have to grasp it. The mind itself becomes something that's palpable. And from both sides of that process, the translator has to attain that mind within his or her own language. And Karnross was absolutely right about that, of course.